What was a rather sleepy part of the offseason has been interrupted by big news out of Oklahoma City. Russell Westbrook agreeing to a renegotiation and extension of his contract. He gets about $9 million more this year and then gets to lock in for another $60 million over the next 2 years, but he does have a player option. So basically, he is taking $9 million this year and $60 million more in guaranteed money to lock into the Thunder for one more year. Danny, what are your initial thoughts after hearing this?
If a renegotiation extension for Russ was going to happen, I think these were the terms it was always going to be, and there are a couple reasons for that. The biggest one being that it fits his timeline really well. So what happens is that he locks in for that second season, you know, at a high value and gets the raise this year, but then maintains the ability to become a free agent in 2018. Which is when he will get to the 10-year experience tier, which is basically what Durant did as well. It's just that he hit unrestricted free agency to do the same thing. And that, while we don't know what the CBA is going to do, I think it is a reasonable estimation to think that the 10-plus line will matter.
I hope they get rid of that.
So do I.
We talked before about, and this is yet another one of these instances of the owners protecting themselves from themselves. They want to have it, so you can only get the 25% max early on because they don't want to have to give out bigger rookie extensions for purportedly unproven players. And then you have the other side of that is you have guys with 10 or more years of experience get the 35% max. And so you've got guys like Durant. He didn't want to lock in for his contract. You had Westbrook. Now, maybe he would have signed a longer extension if he didn't have the carrot of, oh, now you can be a free agent when you have 10 plus years of experience. It makes no sense in terms of how players actually age. It also allows for more super teams to be formed if the owners supposedly aren't against that. So that's really, I hope they just make one max 35% for the entire NBA in the next CBA. But for right now, under the current rules, I think it was a good deal for both sides. We talked about when we did Oklahoma City's offseason grades that this was an offer that financially made sense for Westbrook. And Oklahoma City was lucky enough to have the cap space. They either due to fortune or due to planning did not extend Deion Waiters last summer. And now they're able to move on from him and have this extra cap space to where they could renegotiate and extend Westbrook. And it seemed like, you know, you made this offer that made financial sense to him. And then if he had said no, they could have traded him with a clean conscience. And as it turned out, he said yes.
And they can still trade him with a somewhat less clean conscience. Basically, part of the timing of this, which is so fascinating, is that there is a 6-month restriction where he cannot be traded because that's basically a circumvention thing. Because otherwise it would violate the rules on renegotiation.
I don't think it's that. I think it's that if he gets it's the extension thing. If he gets more than 7.5%.
When you violate the terms of what you could do with a new team, then you can't be traded to basically do it that way. And so what that means is that there's a 6-month hold on him basically being traded. Coincidentally, 6 months from now is early February and the trade deadline is later in February, so he could still be traded even this season.
Yeah, and it was important that they got this deal done at this point, perhaps for that reason. And I don't think that there's anything sinister about that.
No.
I think another reason, in addition to the fact that Westbrook just gets $9 million that he couldn't have gotten and some extra security in exchange for locking in longer, it takes away this impetus now of, oh, we have to come to a resolution here, which I don't know that either party necessarily really wanted. They don't know what this team is going to be. Are they going to be a 51-win team where they look pretty good and then they can get into 2017 free agency, which we'll talk about how that'll look in a second, or are they going to be a 500 team? I happen to think that they're actually going to be a little bit closer to the latter just because I don't think the pieces fit together that well in the team, but they also could make some moves to add some more shooting, which I think would help them. So it was just Russ wasn't ready to leave. This is a calamity. The organization didn't expect Kevin Durant to leave. And so now at least they bought themselves some time to see how this marriage really works. And if it looks like they're not close to contention, if it looks like Russ wants to go elsewhere so that he can be part of a contender, if Oklahoma City realizes they're not close and they just need to rebuild at this point, then both parties can go in that direction. But without that information, it was really difficult to resolve the situation. And they are, while the cap spike definitely burned them with Kevin Durant having a superior destination in his mind in Golden State, it at least helps them here to keep Westbrook under contract for another year.
Yeah, it helps them for another year. And I would say that there is another parallel to Harden, because Harden is also a guy who the timing of his led to the 10-plus. You know, like, he's a guy who's at the threshold. So these three former Thunder teammates all largely kind of made the same logic, though they got there in different ways, each of them. And I think that with Westbrook, the timing of this is fascinating in terms of that. And also, I don't expect, just personally, I don't expect them to trade him this season. I just out of instinct, you know, unless things went really badly, I think they would want to sort it out. However, it does open the door for a reasonable but amicable parting if they make a decision after the season, because I just think they won't have enough information by February unless something really goes wrong.
So Russell Westbrook decided that he was comfortable in Oklahoma City, but not as comfortable as you can be in your underwear with MeUndies. If you're wearing a suit or sweats, you're spending 24 hours a day in your underwear. So it makes sense that you would want the most comfortable fabric available for your underwear. MeUndies has that. It's called Modal, which every pair of MeUndies is made from. It's sustainably sourced and a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. I was skeptical about it. They sent me a few pairs. They sent my girlfriend a pair of their lounge pants, and it really is incredibly comfortable, the most comfortable underwear that I've ever owned. But you don't have to take my word for it. If you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they are free, no questions asked. And they have a ton of styles. They have limited edition prints, too, if you want to kind of jazz up your style a little bit. So shipping is free in the U.S. and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Of course, the way to get even more of a discount is via MeUndies.com/capspace. We talk about it all the time in the program. Easy to remember. You can get 20% off your first order. And just importantly, let them know that you came from us and support the show. So it's MeUndies.com/capspace to get 20% off your first order. MeUndies.com/capspace. Get that sustainably sourced Modal, which I can never pronounce, but it is much more comfortable to wear than it is to pronounce. MeUndies.com/capspace is the URL. So let me ask you this question. If you're Russell Westbrook, we talked about how it might make financial sense for him to have done this, but if your goal was simply to be in the best possible situation to potentially win a championship, thinking about some of the teams that have cap space next summer or potentially getting traded somewhere this year, would you have signed this deal, or would you have tried to go to another destination instead?
So there were, in terms of trading right now, I saw two real contenders, and those being the Celtics and the Lakers. One goes one way, one goes the other way. On the Celtics, he has, to me, a substantially better chance of winning than he does on the Thunder. They have better talent, even after they have to give up substantial guys to get Russell Westbrook. And they also have those draft assets that would either be involved in the trade or could add other players. The Lakers have a more bare cupboard right now, so it would go that way. So it depends a little bit, but my guess is that the Lakers would have held a little firmer than the Celtics, just because the Celtics are, you know, they have all these things kind of burning a hole in their pocket. So I would go that direction, saying that, you know, not signing this would have facilitated that. But it's not a substantial thing, and I think getting the information about Oklahoma City is good too, because they still have talent. I don't think it's championship level talent, but they still have a lot of good guys.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that this team is going to be, you know, maybe a 45 win type of team, because I think they just don't have enough shooting right now. I think also their defense could take a bit of a step back without Durant, without Ibaka as well. Oladipo has some defensive talent, but hasn't really put it together in terms of his actual production defensively yet. Russ isn't that good on that end. They've got Robertson, but he can't shoot, so who knows how much he's going to play, especially down the end of games. And then Cantor, of course, is a bit of a liability. Ilyasova, they don't really have
anybody. And their swingman depth in general, like, that's the big issue, is they have these guys that can kind of bounce around a little bit in position, but it doesn't really matter if you can do that if you can't man the other places. Like, Robertson's probably going to play because they don't have enough other threes, unless Abrines really steps up early and can play, you know, let's say 20 minutes a game to fill some of that spot.
Yeah, and we're going to talk, actually, Olympics preview with my buddy Christian Pelletier from Finland, who's an expert on international basketball. He actually thinks that Abrines is going to be a little bit of a disappointment, so stay tuned for that later when we do our Olympics preview later in the episode. But I think, for me, yeah, I think he has a better chance of winning in Boston. San Antonio, we've talked about, will have max space. I don't know if Russ is a San Antonio guy or not. I don't really know him well enough to say that. I'm not saying he is. I'm not saying he isn't. So
Minnesota would have been fascinating. Unlikely,
yeah.
But...
I think there definitely will be plenty of better options for him. And while he probably doesn't think this way, getting to be 28 as he will be next summer, 29 the year after that when he actually now will be a free agent, I think he has really, you know, maybe 2-3 years left at this point as potentially being the best player on a championship team. I think he needs to go somewhere where he can team up with other stars. And so maybe what the plan will be now in the summer of 2017 is they try to get in some other free agents, but they could run into the same problem that they reportedly ran into with Al Horford this year, where Russ again could leave after a year. And so is Blake Griffin, most notably, and they're also going to have to dump Cantor probably to fit in a max space. It'd be between maybe 10 or 15 million in space without dumping his $18 million salary next summer. Then without Russ saying, hey, I'm going to stay for sure, how do you get another big free agent? And you're in the almost the exact same position that you were this summer.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I'm happy you brought it up because I've been thinking about it. And Oklahoma City has notorious trouble for getting free agents, you know, like the highest paid guy I think they had before, you know, the last couple of years was Nenad Krstić. It was Krstić and Morrow, you know, those guys.
Well, this is another one of those teams where
it was an opportunity. They
never had more than the mid-level to offer. So to say, I mean, really the only guy I felt like they were reportedly in the mix for that they didn't get was Pau Gasol in the summer of 2014. Yeah. Other than that,
just intuitively, you know, I think that it's a place that could have some sales trouble, just like some other places have. And so we'll see. I mean, Danilo Gallinari would be a fascinating fit with them. We'd have to see if he would really hit the market. And there are a couple other guys that you could consider. Blake is the most obvious because of his ties, but we'll see what he wants. I mean, Blake is going to hit unrestricted free agency for the first time, and that will be really notable in that sense. And so, yeah, Oklahoma City is going to have that opportunity, assuming they keep Russ for this year, which I expect them to. And also...
Well, let's talk about that real quick.
Go ahead.
Because we got to talk, too, about their rookie extensions, because you would have thought their usual MO is we extend guys for cheaper, and if they don't extend, then we try to move them. They now really can't do that if they plan to use cap space in the summer of 2017. They have Steven Adams with a $7 million cap hold, Oladipo, his cap hold, depending on whether he's above or below the estimated average player salary, I think with his $6.5 million this year, he will be below that. So his cap hold will be almost $16 million, would be huge. But still probably less than he's likely to get in an extension. And then Robertson also will have a $5.4 million cap hold. All those guys, I mean, you have to imagine Oladipo and Adams are probably going to make $40 million between them, and Robertson will at least get eight figures. So they're going to keep those small cap holds on the books. That's the only way you get some space. But then if they extend all those guys and they sign someone to a max contract, even if they move on from Cantor, you're going to be into the tax. So that's another issue. I mean, to get the two superstars, I think they would do that. But it's something to watch and to see, knowing that all those guys are going to hit restricted free agency and that they're all pretty good. That, I think, is something that could really explode their bill as opposed to being able to lock them in earlier now. But they're not going to have the opportunity to do that. Maybe Oladipo, you could say they would do it with him because his cap hold is so high. Maybe if they get him for, you know, a 4-year, $80 million deal, they could start him low enough that you're only sacrificing maybe a million or two. But Adams and Robertson, it's almost impossible to imagine that those guys could get done that.
Yeah, and you also have to think about those guys getting substantial raises in the context of what happens if they strike out, because then you are in a very different situation where you have good players, you know, hopefully with Adams and Oladipo and all that, but you're not having them cheap anymore. So if, let's say, they strike out, that makes it less likely that Westbrook is going to stay. Then paying Victor Oladipo and Steven Adams combined, let's say $40 million a year, gets a lot less palatable, because then you don't have the stars around those guys. And so I think they're going to have a series of different battle plans for that offseason, because it affects it. But at the same point, you know, we thought they were pot committed when they got Deion Waiters. They ended up not being that way. But Oladipo is a superior prospect. So it would be weird to see, because really the only option there, considering how weak sign-in trades are now, would be to just let them go. And that feels unlikely, too.
Yeah, they also... Another issue is Cantor, who would have one guaranteed year left on his contract, then a player option for the next year. So I guess they're both guaranteed, but he could opt out after that, you know, making over $18 million over those 3 years. I'm sorry, it would be 2 years after that. Is he tradable to just get rid of him? I don't think so, given what we've seen about the center market, unless he just has an unbelievable year and proves that he can play power forward, which seems unlikely, shall we say, that he could defend the power forward position. So they may have to attach an asset to get rid of him and then to hopefully get someone in free agency. I mean, they could sort of do what the Warriors did with Bogut this year if they can really get someone to come. But I do think that the odds of that are relatively low, especially if the Clippers were willing to offer Blake Griffin his full 5-year max. With his injury history, I think he would have to take that. I think he really likes being in L.A. as well, and you don't necessarily see any other free agents other than maybe Gallo, who they, again, would have to really overpay, who would come there, and I don't think that Gallo moves the needle to get these guys back into championship contention. So I think that they did succeed in kicking the can down the road for a year. That's important to get more information with Russ, but it is, I think the odds of them getting someone who really makes a difference in free agency next year are 10-15%, something like that, and then you're right back where you started with him again this summer, and that you now cannot extend him again. So he could very easily just get traded again next summer.
Yeah, and one other real concerning thing for Oklahoma City about the timing is that one of the best assets they could get would be draft picks in what appears to be a pretty strong 2017 draft class. But the draft will occur before they find out who they could get in free agency. So they can't really play that by ear unless they want to do another Jeremy Lamb where they trade a guy for players that the other team already drafted, but that requires a lot of luck, and that team would have not fallen in love with that player.
All right, anything else we got to talk about on this? I think we've hit pretty much everything that I wanted to.
In terms of Russ, no, but I just wrote a piece for the Sporting News on renegotiations, extensions. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that there are some other options here for guys who could go a similar route that we've already seen with Harden and with Westbrook.
Yeah, so there were originally more teams, because one of the things that we have to mention with renegotiations and extensions is that they require actual cap space. A straight extension does not, but a renegotiation does, because that's really how the system works. So there were players like Serge Ibaka, DeMarcus Cousins, Drew Holiday, where it was a potential thing. They were eligible for it, but those teams have spent their cap space, so they're not out of it. So the guys that I focused on for the piece that came out in the Sporting News today on Thursday were on two teams, the Pacers and the Jazz. And so for the Pacers, it's Paul George or Jeff Teague. And for the Jazz, it's Derek Favors or George Hill.
One thing I would say, though, for those teams like the Magic, for example, if Serge Ibaka likes it there, if Jeff Green isn't playing, or even the Jazz, too, they've got Hill and Favors, you mentioned. Maybe they could, if Dia isn't really in the rotation, they could move him at the deadline, because you can actually renegotiate up until March 1st.
Right.
So you could move guys at the deadline to actually open up more space. I think as like Jody Meeks, $6 million expiring contract with the Magic as well. I think they could still potentially open up some space to renegotiate and extend Ibaka if they wanted to do that. But part of the reason you renegotiate and extend is that you do it with enough time left in the season where, all right, there's a whole year's worth of risk for someone like Ibaka or Westbrook that I could get injured over this year. If you're already at the trade deadline, now there's only a third of a year's worth of risk. And so some of the incentive for renegotiating and extending, it's like, why do it when you're just so close to free agency? You can see that light at the end of the tunnel. But that is something to consider. So what about those four that still actually have space now? What would that look like for them?
So the most interesting guy to me is Paul George. And so Paul George has two more years on his contract and then has a player option for that year. So that makes him different than James Harden, because he could do it. I mean, we all expect him to opt out, but he actually could, you know, theoretically opt in. So
yeah,
Paul
so
George,
summer of 2018 for him is when he most likely will be a free agent, but his contract actually runs through 2019. That's that player option on the last
correct round. And so they could give him a substantial raise. I believe it's about $8 million a year, because is the same deal as Russ. And so that's a lot of money over the next 2 years. And, you know, if he's happy with it. And the reason why I've been pushing for guys like Paul George and Derek Favors is that there, if I were those teams, is that there is a risk mitigation there, because, yeah, waiting, those guys get a higher max salary. But if they're amenable to it now, it helps balance your books a little bit, because they're at a lower salary, even though you're giving them a raise. And because you never know if they're going to change their mind. You know, Derek Favors would be doubling his salary, because he's only making $11.5 million. But so you don't know if he'll see free agency a year from now as just being a year away and go, oh, okay, I'd rather just hit that, whether it be staying in Utah or anything else. So for both of those guys, locking it in now would be great for the teams and for the players. I don't know what they want, but it could be a feasible thing for them.
Yeah, with Indiana, what do they have? Like basically like $7 million or so in cap space left to work with, something like
that?
About
that, yeah. But they could clear a little bit if they had to.
Yeah, they could maybe move on from a Rodney Stuckey or a C.J. Miles, a Lavoy Allen to open up a little more space if they wanted to give Teague even more than he's, because he's only making 8.8 right now. You know, what do you think it would take for Jeff Teague to, who will be 29 next summer, what would it take for him to want to renegotiate and then extend even for like a full 3-year deal, you know, presumably with a player option on the end of that? Because he could actually sign on for 3 more years. And do you think if they, from the team side, what would you be willing to offer him? Maybe that's a better question.
Well, I'm a little lower on Teague than the Pacers are, but something in the, let's say, $16 million starting raise. So that would give him about a $7.5 million raise, a little less than that right now. And then on top of that, you could build from there. But I would expect he would be asking in the $17 to $18 million starting range, which is a little bit more to give up in terms of salary and a lot more of a commitment for another couple of years.
One of the things that I don't think anybody really has the space for, but maybe the Pacers could if they move some salary, is the idea of starting someone in, giving someone a bump who isn't really a max player up to near the max this year. And then you can do up to a 40% decline on the extension. So you're basically kind of putting more of the cap hit into this year, a year when there wasn't really that much in terms of salaries out there, in terms of free agents who are really going to move the needle. And then you sort of pay the piper this year with that deal, and then they have a much lower salary in years to come. That's something that Oklahoma City did with Nick Collison under the old CBA. They changed the rules a little bit, but you can still fix it so you can front-load contracts. It's one of the few ways that you can do something like that. But I don't think we're necessarily going to see that this year. Maybe that's something that we'll see in 2017. Another guy who in 2017 is probably the biggest candidate and is going to be in a very similar situation to where Russell Westbrook was this year is DeMarcus Cousins. And he will have 8 years of experience when his contract expires in the summer of 2018. So he doesn't have sort of that 10-year carrot the way Westbrook did, being 1 year away. So it would kind of make more sense for him to renegotiate and extend for 2 years. But we'll see. The Kings are slated to have plenty of space right now for next summer. We'll see if they retain that. We'll see if Cousins would be interested in extending. A lot obviously depends on how this year
goes. Well, and also with Cousins, it's important to note that if he were traded, let's say like at the trade deadline, he could do that with his new team as well. So
yes,
that would be, let's say he got traded to a team, I don't know exactly who it would be, but if it were to a team that had some space next summer, that option would be on the table then, and they could even have they can't have an agreement, but they could have an understanding about that for then.
All right, we ready to get to some news here?
Let's do it.
Disappointing news out of Toronto. I was actually at this game, and it didn't look good. Where Delon Wright, 4 months on the shelf now after shoulder surgery. He had a labral tear that was more, they popped it back into place on the scene, but it turned out to be more severe than I think they originally thought. So again, he's the guy who at age 24 really needed to kind of take a step forward this year, and having him, at least he got a summer league in, but having him now not really able to work out for that amount of time is really a shame for any kind of young player.
It certainly is, and while they have point guards that they can rely on in terms of Lowry and Corey Joseph, he could be a useful depth piece for them, and it's also important to evaluate a player, especially as you said, he's older than a lot of guys who come into the league, and that also helps explain, though it didn't need explanation, the value of having Fred VanVleet being another guy, and I think that really makes it more possible that he at least starts the year as their 15th man, so he can be kind of their utility point guard if need be.
Clearly, Bob Myers listens to the Downtown Basketball Podcast because the Warriors signed JaVale McGee.
They did, and he is on a we haven't heard exactly whether it's non-guaranteed, lightly, partially guaranteed, whatever, but basically, you know, not fully guaranteed. And I just worked on a piece that will come out for The Athletic very soon about that last roster spot because they have 14 guaranteed contracts. And I think JaVale McGee has a substantially higher ceiling than a lot of the guys they have on guaranteed deals. And that is a high ceiling does not mean a high floor because he has a very low floor and he has a lot of other issues. But his ability to block shots and run the floor is something that Golden State actually didn't have from their centers, unless you think more highly of James Michael McAdoo than I do.
Yeah, Andre Iguodala actually played with him in Denver in 2012-13. And so you would imagine that they asked Andre kind of about him a little bit on background. I think that McGee does offer some skills. I don't see Steve Kerr really playing him that much. I think that Steve really skews, especially on bench guys, towards more of the, like many coaches, obviously, towards more of the solid vet, or at least perceived to be solid vet. I think Varejao still will get more time than Miguel, though Varejao is on the shelf for the moment with a back injury that's not believed to be serious, but he's out of the Olympics. So I think McGee could make the team. He's, for a long time, has been a high upside guy. We've talked about as someone who could break out, I think, with all of his health problems being, I think he's either 28 or 29 now. That probably is in the rearview mirror, but as someone who could just give them a little something on the second unit, I don't know that there are any better options out there. So a decent sign for the Warriors. They also picked up Elliot Williams, a former stalwart of theirs in Santa Cruz. Very good D-League player, shooting guard, about 6'5", was the 22nd pick, I think, back in like the 2010 draft, I want to say, with Portland. And we'll see what happens with him. I mean, they're familiar with him, and they do have kind of a hole at backup shooting guard. Maybe he can come in and compete with Pat McCaw there. As a signing that I like substantially better, and you would have wondered why the Warriors didn't get in on him, or maybe they did, was Allen Anderson going to the Clippers.
Yeah, Allen Anderson, a guy that we've liked for a long time, and due to some injury concerns, he barely played this year for the Washington Wizards. He was basically got a lower salary, and the Clippers have absolutely killed it with minimum contract guys. I mean, we did a, when we talked about them in the offseason grades, you know, they had this issue where they paid long-term money to Austin Rivers and to Jamal Crawford and lost Jeff Green. But since that all that happened, they've reacted really well. Brandon Bass, Maurice Spates, Raymond Felton, and Allen Anderson, that is an excellent group of minimum contracts.
Yeah, we haven't heard any information on the guarantee. You assume that it's probably fully guaranteed for Anderson, and I think it's more likely than not that they don't get anything out of Anderson. He's 33. He missed most of the year with injuries last year in Washington. But if he's healthy, I think he still could be at least a lower-end rotation guy for a team that has missed even anyone approximating a 3-and-D option on the wing next to J.J. Redick. So yeah, great signing there. Ronnie Price going to Oklahoma City in the Nazi Muhammad Memorial roster spot there. Just going to be a solid bet. I think it's actually reported as a 2-year deal, probably for the minimum. But Price, a guy that everybody always seems to like to have around as a locker room presence, and not a guy who could really play anymore. I will say that he's supposedly this great locker room presence, but he's also been on some teams that have had really bad locker rooms, like the Lakers and Suns the last 2 years. So maybe that is a little bit overstated. At least, you know, he may be a great guy, but to suggest that he's going to have some huge impact that wouldn't have already been there might be a little bit of a stretch.
And of course, we can't let this transactional thing go without talking about David Lee. David Lee signed a 2-year deal with the San Antonio Spurs. The second year is a player option, so it's, you know, 2 years at the minimum. And, you know, he's a guy who can contribute, you know, low-end rotation minutes in the regular season, though Boston, he basically got excised from their rotation, though he did better in Dallas. But what bothers me about it is it's another player who absolutely should not be on the floor in the later rounds of the playoffs because of his defense.
Yeah, he's a guy who could be totally fine for them in the regular season, just keeping guys' minutes down a little bit. He's really only effective offensively as a center. Can't stop anybody at either position now in the front court. He did get that second year player option, which makes some sense. We'll see whether he actually ends up exercising that for a team that wants to use some cap space, but if it really gets desperate, they could always just stretch him. And it is very satisfying to see both Lee and Pau Gasol, probably the two guys in the last 5 years who have been most overrated by the double-double stat, on the same team now.
Yeah, David Lee, Mr. Double-Double when he was on Golden State.
We never talked about the tweaks to Hakka, which I think, basically, if you haven't seen it, they are now extending the prohibition on fouling away from the play in the last 2 minutes of the fourth quarter to the last 2 minutes of every other quarter. This just seems like one of those things where you split the baby, you compromise, and nobody's happy.
It appears that they identified that there is a problem, but didn't do nearly enough to fix the problem. And I think what concerns me the most is that it doesn't really fix it. It just modifies it in a different way. And so basically you're saying there's something, but you don't really want to do anything more innovative. And also, I don't know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it kind of seems like, given the timing, that they're also not making any moves on any of the kind of, in some ways, more egregious things, like the charge rule that we've talked about, you know, fouling in the backcourt, fixing clear path. they did fix the J.J. Redick piggyback ride, which is good. I'm happy they did that. That was an obvious thing. But
yeah, that will now be a flagrant foul.
That will now be a flagrant foul, and so that's good. But it's just not, it's not enough, especially now that they've agreed finally that it's a problem.
At least they eliminated perhaps the most egregious part of it, which is that it made sense, essentially, if there was a poor free throw shooter on the floor in the last minute of quarters, to just foul on every possession, even because you're just getting an extra possession on it. Even if the guy was like a 60% free throw shooter, the math kind of worked out in that. So at least you're eliminating that now.
And the 2-for-1, even in that circumstance as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. And you're also eliminating the minutes where there is most likely to be Hakka, because that's when you're most likely to already be in the bonus, so there's not as much opportunity cost to doing it. But it still doesn't go far enough for me. It at least acknowledges that it's bad. I think, you know, the statistic that Silver threw out there was, I think, 45% of all Hakkas will be eliminated. I'm not so sure that that's true. I mean, it may well be the case that 45% of Hakkas occurred during the last 2 minutes of quarters, but now, because you can't do it in the last 2 minutes, we'll probably see teams that really want to do that strategy accelerate it to do it more often before that 2 minute prohibition ends in. But there really is just no rational reason why you would just draw the line at the last 2 minutes of the quarter, other than to just prevent that kind of 2-for-1 hacking that we talk about. But it seems like this is just all that Silver could push through, and some change is better than none.
Two other things that I want to note. One is that, by the way that it seems like it's structured, there will still be those kind of like incidental, like running into the screener kind of fouls where it's not Hakka, but you just like basically do that. And I'm a little bit worried for, and sometimes for the safety of those guys, because if you're just trying to do enough to get a foul, like maybe you'll just plow through DeAndre Jordan, either guy could get hurt. And then the other thing is, will coaches adapt to this? Because something that I've said for, like, I said this because I cover the Warriors for Bogut, was that they should play him at the beginning of quarters, because there's just a reduced amount of every quarter to do Hakka. Whether teams will stagger that with like Andre Drummond and pull him maybe a little earlier and make sure that he plays the last 2 minutes of every quarter.
Yeah, that's certainly what they should do. Same thing with DeAndre Jordan now. Now that would force them to take basically two rests for half, but I'm a proponent of that happening anyway. Another thing too, at least, while you can just like foul on Andre Drummond as he's going to set a screen or something, at least that requires that the person who is guarding him, who would be another big man, probably commit the foul, or be like an actual player who isn't just put into the game solely for the purpose of fouling. So that is at least a slightly larger deterrent as well. But hopefully this will just be, what'll happen is, I mean, I've always felt like the key to this was just make it as much of a farce as possible. And so now, if we have every announcer groaning because of 4 minutes left in the quarter, they got into the bonus, now we know for sure this next 2 minutes is going to be Hakka until this arbitrary deadline when it's not. Hopefully that level of ridiculous will allow there to be additional change and the practices outlawed entirely. All right, anything else we got to talk about before we get to the Olympics preview?
No, I think that's about it. I'm excited to listen to it.
All right, we will be back with Christian Pelletier in a second. But first, a message from the Naked 3 Fitness Tracker, the world's first home body scanner. This is a product that I was just incredibly excited by. I came across it just when a doctor friend of mine sent it to me on Facebook, and he was interested in it because we always do these little fitness bets where we try to see who can lose the most weight or who can like improve their fitness the most, lose the most body fat. And this is going to be great for us because now we can just measure where we're at pretty much every day at home. The way the product works is you step onto a scale that rotates in front of a mirror that has sensors in it, and you get a 3D scan of your body. It can tell you what your body fat percentage is. It can compare where you were a week ago or a day ago, give you a heat map of where you've gained muscle and lost fat. It's really just a revolutionary product. They sell these for gyms and it costs like 10 grand. You have to go in and pay a bunch of money to get it done. Now you can just get it done at home. In the spring of 2017, when it goes on sale, it's going to be $999, but you can get it right now by locking in a $699 price with just a $95 deposit. And you can get another $50 off of that by going to naked.fit/capspace. That URL, easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program, lets them know that you came from us and gets you that discount. And then if you sign up, you get your own referral code. So you can share that on Facebook. And for everyone of your friends that gets one as well, you get $50 off and they get $50 off too. So you could theoretically, if you get 14 friends to buy one, you could get yours for free. Then maybe that won't happen, but you can get a nice little discount if you get a couple of them to sign up. So naked.fit/capspace. I'm really just excited to have this product on the podcast. You can order yours at naked.fit/capspace.
All right, now let's bring in for our Olympic preview one of my favorite European analysts. He was on last year for a couple of episodes, and we talked about Eurobasket 2015. Christian Pelletier, who is the play-by-play analyst for the NBA and the EuroLeague in Finland, and also an assistant on Finland's under-18 team, which unfortunately looks like they may not get to play. But the advantage is now we get your analysis on the Olympics. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So I think the place to start here for this is the first time we've talked about the Olympics on this podcast. Obviously, they're once every 4 years. So we should probably just do a refresher of what the format of the tournament is with these 12 teams.
All right. So there's two groups of six teams, and the top four from each group after round robin. So everybody plays each other. So the top four teams of each group enter the quarterfinals, and then it's just the knockout stage, one game each. So to win the tournament, or if Team USA wants to go perfect, for example, they would have to win eight games to do so.
Yeah. And so what is the group setup now, with this field?
So Group A, which looks pretty reasonable, especially from the U.S. point of view, is the USA, France, Serbia, Australia, Venezuela, and China. And Venezuela actually won the FIBA Americas last summer, which was kind of surprising. And the Group B, which has been titled the Group of Death in this case, which is accurate, has Spain, Croatia, Lithuania, Argentina, Brazil, and Nigeria. None of the six teams, in my opinion, are that bad, although Nigeria has some issues after losing a couple of players due to insurance reasons. But five definitely pretty good teams in that group.
Yeah, and so the top four are going to make it, as you said. And so what we'll do here is we'll kind of go through each of the teams. But first, I think what's important is you can't discuss a FIBA tournament without the possibility of potentially tanking for seeding. That's always been a legendary thing. We saw it with Australia, allegedly, in the 2014 World Cup, that teams desperately want to avoid the U.S. for as long as they can in the tournament. So the U.S. is in Group A. They presumably are going to finish first. And so how does it set up then? What are sort of the good places to finish and the bad places to finish to avoid the U.S. if you're in these groups?
So the first, whoever finishes first in Group A, which should be the U.S., if nothing crazy happens, will play whoever finishes fourth in Group B. And that also means that the team who finishes second in Group A will go to the opposite side of the bracket to play the third placed team from Group B. And also at the opposite side of the bracket will be the winner of Group B. So if you're in Group B, they're probably going to avoid trying to finish second or fourth. And from Group A, it's possible that some team will avoid finishing third. Although in Group A, in Group A, the scheduling to do that is a bit tougher than in the other group.
Why do you say that?
There's not really any big games on the last 2 days of group play. The U.S. plays, I think, France and Serbia, but Australia, France and Serbia, the other games they play are against Venezuela and China. So I don't think they're going to be tanking those games because they might be getting knocked out of the top four altogether if they do that. It's possible that it can still happen on the last day or something, but most likely the group's going to be pretty set after the first 3 days of play.
Yeah, and the other thing we always see in these tournaments is supposedly teams don't try their hardest in the group stage. I mean, you would think that Serbia and France would be the candidates for that when they're going against the U.S., but if they play those two teams last, then I guess they could potentially be in a position where they're trying to get second in the group and, you know, maybe the point differential could come into play or something like that. So maybe we won't see quite as much tanking against the U.S. or just sort of not necessarily tanking, but strategically not putting your best foot forward. We saw, for example, Spain got completely blown out in 08 in the group stage and then gave the U.S. a great game in the 08 final. And people said, you know, they didn't try that hard in the first game. I don't know that we're necessarily going to see that as much this game from France and Serbia.
No, I don't think so either, especially since how the schedule's made up in Group A. But in Group B, it's a bit different. Lithuania and Croatia actually play on the final day of group play, and they might be in a situation where they both would try to lose that game, which might end up looking kind of silly, but we'll see what happens. Also, Brazil and Argentina play on the second to last day, which could have a pretty big impact on the group.
Yeah, I mean, I think those teams that you mentioned,
Lithuania and Croatia, probably.
Yeah, Lithuania and Croatia. It is very possible that those teams could be fighting for second if you assume that Spain is going to get first, and second obviously is the one that you want to avoid, because then you go into the U.S. side of the bracket. So
precisely.
All right, enough on the tanking here. Let's kind of take a look at some of these teams. We'll start with France. I think that they, to me, are the biggest threat to the U.S. overall. Would you agree with that?
I guess matchup-wise, if you're talking what team can actually guard the U.S. in any way, I would agree with you that it's France. But again, what kind of issues can France really cause the U.S. on the other end of the floor is, to me, the bigger question, which I doubt will be too hard for the U.S. to handle, in all honesty. Unless Diaw has like a fantastic tournament and Tony Parker somehow finds the fountain of youth or something. But I have France finishing second as well. The big thing to note, obviously, is that Evan Fournier is out. He had the free agency situation going on, so he wasn't in the qualifying tournament. And then Coach Collet decided that their backcourt is fine without Fournier being there. So him being out is kind of significant for their wing scoring. Ajin Sah, Mahin Mee were also left off the roster, and as was Joakim Noah, but he hasn't been part of the French setup for a while. But I mean, I agree. I have France finishing second behind the U.S. in the group, but I honestly don't see a big shot of France challenging the U.S. or even giving them a close game.
Yeah, France has long kind of punched below their weight offensively in these tournaments, and I think part of that is just due to the fact that they haven't had the spacing for a long time. But now with Decolo, Batum, Dia, if they had brought Fournier, maybe that would have been better. They actually could have gotten there. I mean, I think one of my big problems with the way Collet coached, and he has done a great job at times. You know, he engineered that huge upset in the World Cup in 2014 of Spain on Spanish soil, but he really likes to play two bigs. Doesn't really space the floor. So I agree. I think they're going to have big problems scoring against this U.S. defense, which looks like a monster. But I also think they are by far the best equipped to actually guard the U.S., especially with Rudy Gobert available. If the U.S. decides to play with the traditional center, Gobert could have a pretty big impact. And Batum is a good athlete. Nando Decolo also, I think, is someone who, you know, is probably the best player in Europe this past year. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I completely agree. And actually, I think he's the best point guard on the French team at the moment. I think he's almost a better player than Tony Parker, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he outscored Parker 18 points a game to 14 in the qualifying tournament in the Philippines that they won. So
yeah,
there's some support for that at this point.
For sure. And like you said, seeing France score against the U.S., I don't see any matchup that the French are going to have a lot of success with. I mean, I don't know how they create an advantage on offense. I mean, they have to find some sort of matchup or some sort of scheme that makes the U.S. at least required to help at least on some level, so that the French get some sort of like power play situations on the weak side or anything like that. But that would have been Tony Parker's pick and roll a few years back, but it's just not an issue for the U.S. anymore. Unless Diaw has lost a couple of pounds and is a bit more mobile, I think he's the only player that can cause the U.S. some headache for some stretches, but not for 40 minutes though.
Yeah, and Batum, he's probably, I would say, the second or the best player in this tournament who is not on the U.S. roster, but I think they have so many athletes that they can throw at him in terms of wing defenders.
Exactly.
That it's hard to see him having some of the dominating performances that he's had for France in the last few years. I think also we're going to see France has a lot of guys that they like to play who are just kind of zeros offensively. Like Florent Pietrus is somehow still on this roster. People will remember him as the brother of Michael Pietrus, who's been retired for like 5 years now. Pietrus is basically just like a 6'6 power forward who can't do anything at all offensively. And then Gilles Ball is another guy who, you know, his 3-point shot kind of wanes and waxes, usually wanes. And then someone called Charles Cahoudi, who I had never actually heard of before, averaged 9 points a game in the French league this year. It was decided by Coach Collet would help more than Evan Fournier would.
Yeah. I'm completely on the same page with you. I, especially with Paul George and Kevin Durant to throw at Batum, I just don't see them getting much success off the wings. But yeah, I have them finishing second though.
All right. Well, so we'll kind of get more through our predictions for the tournament. Also, a force in Group A is Serbia. They made it to the final of the World Cup, after which they're blown out by the U.S., but they had a wonderful offensive tournament before that. Had a little bit of a disappointing Eurobasket last year, but then they won their qualifying tournament at home. But the big news for them is that they are missing Nemanja Bjelica, who is out with a nerve issue in his right foot. That's a huge loss for them.
Yeah, Bjelica is I probably might have had Serbia finishing higher up had they had Bjelica. I don't know if Bjelica is such a strong player against the U.S. necessarily, but against other teams, he's probably the only other player who's not on the U.S. roster who plays power forward and knows how to use ball screens, which is a huge asset in a tournament like this when scouting and tactical changes have to be made so quickly within a day or so. Bob Jelica and obviously big Boban Marjanovic both are out. Djordjevic, he's always an entertaining coach. It's fun to watch his games. I don't know if he makes always makes the tactically best decisions, but he definitely gets his team playing hard and has a lot of passion in them. And then Nikola Jokic will be interesting to see how he fits in with the Serbian team. But Milos Teodosic obviously as well is huge, as is Radulic at center.
Yeah, the big problem for the Serbians is that they can't stop anybody.
Yeah.
I think maybe they'll be, because Teodosic, always a guy pretty allergic to defense. Bjelica, never great on that end, although he's not going to be there this time around. Nikola Kalinic is a guy that I've liked before as kind of an athletic combo forward type. We'll see whether he plays more at the three or at the four. And then Nikola Jokic, who I think provides a new dimension for them. He dominated in the qualifying tournament. He averaged 18 points a game and only 20.4 minutes a game, and also led the tournament in rebounding. And he's probably, although he's not like a great NBA defender, he's probably better than some of their other centers. Then they have Radulica, who Clippers fans will remember as still being on their books for a few $100,000 a year because he got stretched a couple of years ago, played for the Bucks as well, kind of a big bruising center they have as a backup. So I think with the pick and rolls with Teodosic, Markovic, another guy too, who can shoot the three, kind of a smaller combo guard type, Bogdanovic, they've got a lot of 3-point shooting on this team and guys who can pass the ball pretty much at every position.
Yeah, but like you said, Teodosic is so hazardous defensively that they're going to give up as many points as almost he creates. But yeah, Teodosic on the pick and roll, and as you said, Jokic and Radulic in the post, they'll be really good offensively. Again, I agree with you, but defense will be the issue for this team.
Yeah, Australia, they are missing Ben Simmons, who decided not to play, and Simmons didn't make their World Cup team 2 years ago either. And I think he doesn't have a ton of love for the Federation at the moment. So they've got Patty Mills and Dellavedova in the backcourt. And then Joe Ingles really is their only kind of high quality wing. They also have Ryan Brokoff, and he's mostly a 3-point specialist. And then, at center is probably their strongest position, but Andrew Bogut is coming back from injury. He said he was really kind of working the cobwebs out, and Aaron Baines as well at center. I mean, what do you think of this team? They played well in the World Cup, as I recall, without Mills, who was coming off a shoulder surgery. But some of the guys who are on that team now are not there any longer.
And Dante Exum is also missing as well.
Right.
Australia is always interesting. They're a fun team to watch. They're coached really well, and they have their sort of own system in place that they keep on keep on developing and it's they play a bit differently than the other teams. They play a lot of dribble handoffs. They shoot the ball a lot. They mix up their defenses a little bit. From a coaching perspective, it's one of those teams I always enjoy watching because they put something different on the court. So I guess in that sense they can cause some problems, but just purely from a talent perspective, well, I agree with you. They don't have a lot of weapons on the wings, and they need to really execute at a really high level to be successful. But they do have centers who can pass the ball, especially Bogut. And if he's healthy, I'm sure they'll be a tough matchup for anybody. But again, the problems are on the wings.
Yeah. I mean, and that's really, we're going to get to the USA next, but that is the biggest difference between the US and these other teams is that, you know, there are maybe 2, 3, 4 NBA quality wings in this entire tournament outside of the US team. There just are not that many 6'6" to 6'8" athletic guys around the world. And, you know, maybe Batum is one of those guys, Giannis, but the Greece is not in this tournament. Even Spain doesn't really have anybody who's kind of above shooting guard level of size to match up with the US. What do you think of this US team, you know, just from sort of an international perspective compared to some of their past outfits?
In a lot of ways, although like a lot of the big names decided to not go this year, in a lot of ways, it's a really well put together group. And in my opinion, I think they have the three best players in the tournament or at least the three best players in the tournament in Kyrie, Durant, and Paul George in some order. And especially since on the wings, they have so much firepower that, like you said, other teams won't match at all. I mean, I guess Spain used to have Rudy Fernandez, but he's not the same player as he was. Batum, as you said, is probably the only other guy who can sort of match up with guys like that. But even Batum isn't nearly on the same level as KD or Paul George. And then some of the, like, Croatia, for example, has a couple of good young wings, but they're so young that they're going to be just overmatched. And, like, if the U.S. had some other holes, like glaring holes in their roster that they didn't have a solid point guard or or a good big rotation, that they only had like a really slow big guy who you can take advantage of defensively, but they have so many different ways to play and so many different units they can throw out there. So it's just really hard to see too many teams or any team actually being able to beat this team.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that this is obviously splitting hairs here with a U.S. team that has a lot of dominating talent, but the weaknesses of this team that I see are passing. I don't think they really have anyone in this team other than Draymond Green that you think of as a great passer. And we saw in some of their exhibition games, particularly against Venezuela, when they only put up 80 points, that they kind of struggled to move the ball. Devolved into a lot of one-on-one. I mean, they have excellent shooting and scoring, but just not guys who do a great job of moving the ball. That's why I like them going with Draymond Green at center. And although all of their lineups in the exhibition games dominated, the ones with him at center were particularly effective. They also just been doing a lot more switching. They can do that 1 through 5 with Green in the game as well. Opponents did have some success attacking DeMarcus Cousins, whether in pick and roll or just by setting pin downs with his man. But again, that's a very small weakness when you look at the grand scheme of things. But I think when Durant is not in the game, we could see this team struggle to score more than expected. But their defense, ever since Tom Thibodeau came on board in 2014, has been pretty much impregnable.
Yeah, that's the big issue. I mean, if you want to beat the U.S., you have to minimize the number of possessions in a game. Because if you try to run against the U.S., you'll just get slaughtered because their points per possession are going to be on average that high that it's just not a smart idea. But if you slow the game down, they're so good defensively. They have so many guys, as you said, who can switch off ball screens or handoffs that it's hard, also so hard to score against them. The only way I can see them losing is if Kyrie has a really bad game or KD gets injured or has some foul trouble and they just can't get anything going offensively and they're not shooting well and somehow the opposition has a day where they put everything they put up through the hoop. But still, it's hard to see them not winning every game by at least 20 points.
Yeah, I think their World Cup team was the first team since 96 that had won every game by 20 points in a major tournament. And it wouldn't surprise me to see that here. I think they could just have a couple of games where they just go cold and don't move the ball that much. They also foul a lot. They love to reach in. And if those get called, that can really slow the game down. If KD could get into foul trouble. Well, so what do you think is the best five-man lineup for this U.S. team if any of the games do actually get close down the end?
As you said, I would definitely have Draymond Green at center. Unless there's some, I guess unless Powell's having a really good game, I don't see, for Spain, I don't see any reason to not have Draymond Green at center.
I think Draymond might actually be the best of those guys at guarding Powell, even compared to Jordan or Cousins.
In some ways, yeah, but I mean,
it's weird to say because he's way smaller.
At least
but
Powell
I think
has such a height advantage over. Yeah, I know, but at least Powell has such a height advantage over Draymond that if he's just hitting everything and if he's getting good post up position, if Spain can execute off balls to get Powell better scoring position, then I guess Draymond could be in a little bit of trouble, and DeAndre might have the height to deal with him. You may be right though, in especially in a 40-minute situation, Draymond might be the best option against Powell. But anyway, I agree with you, Draymond at center. Then Paul George, Kevin Durant, and then Kyrie Irving are like a three I would definitely go with. But then it gets interesting because Melo in FIBA tournaments has always been good, and it's not like he's way over the hill at this point. He can still be effective, but usually in tournaments like this, it's better to have somebody smaller who can penetrate at will. So I don't know if that and it would be either DeMar or.
If you say DeMar, I'm thinking that you're just trying to sabotage us now.
that's true. No, but I mean, or Klay Thompson. But I think the four players are pretty much set, and then it just depends if you want to go bigger on the wings, bigger at the center position, or if you want another guy penetrating. Definitely Paul George, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and Draymond Green. Personally, I would probably go with Klay Thompson down the stretch.
Yeah, I think that is probably what I would do too. Kyrie, if he's not hot, maybe you would go with Lowry because he's a little bit better defensively, also stronger because probably better at switching if they want to switch everything. Or even they could go with Jimmy Butler and not play with a traditional point guard. And then you can really switch everything 1 through 5 as well. But let's get to the other two teams in that group. I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on China and Venezuela. Both of them did not look very good against the U.S. I think both those teams, although Venezuela plays some great defense, and that's how they got to that tournament of the Americas championship last year and upset Canada. I think that it's, I don't really see much hope for them to make it to the knockout stage. Do you agree?
Yeah, I completely agree. And especially with Gravis Vasquez missing, it's not like they have a lot of weapons offensively, and I don't think Vasquez would have made a difference, to be honest with you. Venezuela and China will battle for fifth.
So Spain has a little bit of a different look this year. No Marc Gasol. Pau will be the starting center. I imagine that it'll be Mirotic at the four. He played for them in Eurobasket last year. Ibaka, who is also naturalized, is not on the team. You can only have one naturalized player. That is the reason for that. But really, I think the Spain's problem, I think they're always going to be good on offense. They run some creative sets. They have good shooting. They have good playmaking. I think their problem is just going to be that they can't stop anybody.
Yeah, I agree. Pau Gasol has, especially in the NBA with the defensive 3-second issues, he has a lot of trouble moving quickly enough to protect the basket. With the FIBA rules, though, he's a bit better, always in these tournaments. I know he's a year older again, but he's so long.
Yeah, I guess by the standards of international big men, he's not really that bad. It's really just when you get to the U.S. So yeah, I'm probably being too harsh on him. I think you're right about that.
And also the rules are different. It's you can kind of chase shooters a bit better off the 3-point line without having to worry about the defensive 3-second issue. So Pau doesn't really have to move that much, and he can just kind of use angles and his long arms to protect the rim. But it's not like he's at this stage of his career elite, but he's much better under the FIBA rules and obviously against lesser competition. But yeah, the defense will be an issue. They kind of, I mean, Claver at the small forward, that was a big deal for them in the last European Championships. I thought they were going to run more with that team last year, but it's even clearer with this team that they're really going to slow to a grind. And I assume that's also the way they see that they might 1 out of 100 times beat the U.S. And if it's in the finals, then why not? But they have to minimize possessions, and Pau Gasol needs to be the best player in the tournament for that to happen.
Yeah, when I said it's a little bit of a different look for them as well, I think you have to look at where they're going to be at shooting guard. Fernandez, he's 31 now. He's on the downswing. Juan Carlos Navarro still on the team. The old stalwart is 36 now. So, and then they've got Sergio Yule as well, who also plays some point guard for them. Other players of note, Sergio Rodriguez, who just signed with the Sixers. Ricky Rubio is going to be on the team. And Alex Abrines, who's going to be playing for the Thunder this year as well. Another option at shooting guard, kind of another one of these sort of skinny guys who can get up off of 1 foot and shoot the ball. You know, he's somewhat of a similar player to Fernandez in his youth. My question about this team is, what is their best lineup? Who do you think they'll be starting? Who do you think they'll be going to down the end of these games?
Who they're going to be starting, I think, might be different than who they're going down the stretch. I mean, Rodriguez, he came off the bench for Real Madrid, and he was the best player one of the best players in Europe for the past 2 years. So he might be coming off the bench, but I think down the stretch, it really depends who's having the better offensive game, Rubio or Rodriguez. But the issue with Rodriguez, obviously, is that he can't defend anybody. And as you said with Rudy, he's had back issues for a while. And I know he's 31, but he looks just as old as Navarro. And Navarro is completely useless at this point of his career on the defensive end. And even offensively, his feet just don't work the same way they used to, that he can create an advantage against bigger guys. Mirotic at 4, definitely Pau at 5. Against a lot of teams, I think they'll go with Claver at 3. But against the U.S., I don't know if they get an advantage off of that. I think Yule has to play at the 2 down the stretch. But whether it's Rubio or Rodriguez to close out the game at the point, that might depend from game to game. I personally would go with Rodriguez instead of Rubio.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting choice. They don't really have anyone that I would consider a true 3 on this roster. They've got Rudy, who traditionally has played at the 3 there and kind of been overmatched against larger wings. Abrines also same sort of build as Rudy. Those guys are both 2s. And then you've got Claver, who's really more, a 6'10 4. He'll help out on the boards. That was important, bringing him in, as you mentioned, last year at Eurobasket, but not a guy who does a ton off the dribble either. So it's going to be an interesting job trying to mix and match those guys together, but they have a lot of really smart guys. They have shooting on this team. They at least have Pau, who can protect the basket. I think that was actually a great point you were making about the rules being different, because Pau is effective when he's actually there. It's just in the NBA, if he can't camp out in the lane, he has to actually get there, and he's just too slow to do that. So I think Spain, do you have them as a solid favorite in Group V, or you think that Lithuania or Croatia or even Brazil could give them a run for their money? I'm kind of putting Argentina as the most likely team to not make it to the knockout stage here.
I think Spain's by far the favorite. And back to Abrines, he's going to be in OKC next season, but he's not a player that does anything at a really elite level. He's kind of a solid player all around. I would really be surprised if he ends up playing crunch time minutes for this team. He's an okay shooter, but he's nowhere near the athlete Rudy Fernandez was at one point of his career. And he's not as smart or witty of a player as some of the other Spanish guys. I think he'll be a pretty big disappointment in OKC next season, if he even gets playing time.
Okay.
But yeah, I have Spain as by far the biggest favorite, but clearly ahead of the rest of the pack though.
Yeah. And so do you agree with me that Argentina is kind of the weakest of the main contenders in this group? I guess we didn't really talk a ton about Nigeria. I think that they're a little bit behind even Argentina, but just watching Argentina in the qualifying tournament and just knowing, or not the qualifying tournament, but the, I guess the qualifying tournament a little bit, but then also the exhibitions. I mean, is there anybody on this team who can even like dunk the ball still? Like they are just so old and so unathletic at this point and just they're subsisting on smarts alone.
That's true. 100% agree with you, but Brazil's not good either, in my opinion, at all. I think Argentina can beat Brazil, but no way Argentina beats Croatia or Lithuania. And Nigeria, as you said, they could have actually been kind of a feisty and annoying team. I still would have had them finishing sixth, but without Al-Farouq Aminu and Festus Azili, who, because of the insurance reasons with the Nigerian Basketball Federation, didn't or decided to drop out at the pretty last minute. They'll be sixth, but I actually have Argentina finishing fourth ahead of Brazil.
Interesting. Well, Brazil will have the home court advantage. They definitely have more athleticism, more NBA talent. They've got Barbosa, Marcelo Huertas, who's still on the downside, but at 33, but could still run a pick and roll. I think Raul Neto is someone who can, is very good defensively and has taken some steps forward from where he was a couple of years ago, where he was, you know, close to unplayable. This is another team though that just has absolutely nobody who can play on the wing at all. I mean, their best three man is Alex Garcia, who's this hilarious guy, like 6'4", really jacked, 36 years old, left-handed guy who like shoots this really weird left-handed jumper and does nothing other than that. He's like their best three man.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the issue there. I mean, Marquinhos is also okay, and Barbosa will, he'll again score in bunches during some stretches of a game, but you're going to hate this one because I'm going to talk about soccer for a little bit, but Brazil always seems to play really, really badly, at home during the crucial games. And, Brazil Argentina is actually on the second to last, day of the group stage. And I just wouldn't be surprised at all if Argentina wins that game, because I don't see Brazil beating Croatia or Lithuania, and I don't see Argentina beating Croatia or Lithuania. So it's going to come down to that game, and I can see the witty Argentinians, led by Ginobili and Scola especially, and then maybe a point with La Provitola and Campazzo beating Brazil.
Yeah, they've got Felicio and Nene as their bigs. Ferjão is out of the tournament with a back injury. Splitter obviously is had that hip surgery, so he's out as well. So those are big losses.
And Nogueira and Caboclo are out.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting juxtaposition between Brazil's athleticism. I think they can really, really hurt Argentina on the glass versus Argentina kind of taking advantage of some of these young guys, some more undisciplined guys on Brazil. So yeah, I'm not saying that's a slam dunk. I like Brazil a little bit in that matchup. Let's talk a little bit about Lithuania now. They have a lot of big guys, again, a little bit weak on the wing, although Mačiulis played well in Eurobasket last year, as I recall. What do you think of their chances? What are some of their strengths and weaknesses?
As you said, Mačiulis played well, and he's a stronger player against most other teams. Against the U.S., I don't see him getting too big of an advantage against anybody. Last year, we also talked about Kuzminskas, who actually signed for the Knicks this past summer. A lot of people have been waiting for him to finally break out, and he finally did at the last games at the Eurobasket last year. He's another wing that's, I think, can solidify their starting unit. Matiunas is out, so that's a big player for them missing. But key guys other than that, Montes Colniet, DeSantis, Rinaldo, Zeybutis will be the one and two, and Zeybutis might play a little bit of point.
Yeah, so Zeybutis did not play last year, right?
Or he had a bad tournament, now I'm forgetting. But he was a non-factor at least, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it was because, yeah, as I recall, like it was basically like Kalnietis or bust. And when he played poorly or got in foul trouble, they just had like no one else to handle the ball at all. So I think having Zeybutis back will be helpful for them. And then Valanciunas, I thought he took a nice step forward in Eurobasket, really for the first time in international play that I had seen, but they're going to be needing even more from him. But this is another guy, Spain, very weak defensive rebounding team. Argentina, weak defensive rebounding team. Croatia doesn't have a ton at center either. I think he can really be effective in this group, posting up deep and getting on the offensive boards.
Exactly. And that Lithuania-Croatia game on the final day will be huge to see who avoids the U.S. In a lot of ways, actually, Lithuania is the team for me that might... It's happened before too, that they'll be the team who might cause the U.S. headaches, and in a way that they'll just make the U.S. look really sloppy and bad, but it's not like they'll have enough weapons to actually beat the U.S., but if I had to bet, if they play against the U.S., that would be the closest game for the U.S. That might be the only game which doesn't finish by a greater margin of victory than 20 points. But no way can they beat the U.S. The only team that can beat the U.S. if it's Spain somehow hit everything and play out of their minds. But Lithuania is not capable of that, but they can slow the game down and maybe have the U.S. look bad for a long stretch of the game, but it won't be enough though.
Croatia, they won at Italy in overtime. In what was a bitter disappointment to a certain Italian friend of mine who's been on this podcast before. But it was Bojan Bogdanovic having just a monster qualifying tournament. He averaged 24 a game. Dario Saric also was excellent. And then it kind of drops off a little bit from there, from those two guys, when you get to really like high level international players who have a good resume.
Yeah. Bojan Bogdanovic against, he's probably the biggest matchup nightmare against most European teams because of his size at the three position. Saric, as you said, and then Hezonja, I guess, can be effective if his shot's going for him and he has the confidence to take those shots. But they're missing players as well. Ante Tomic is probably the biggest one who decided to not go this year, and that really hurts them at center. Although Tomic had horrible the past two tournaments, actually, I think. And then Dragan Bender is out after getting drafted, as is Zubac and Damian Rudets. I still have Croatia, Lithuania. Either one of them will finish second. I have Croatia finishing second because I think Lithuania is going to tank that game against them. But I have Lithuania being the better team out of the two.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. Hezonja, although he's got a lot of talent, he's a sexy name from the NBA, high draft pick, he has not really done much in a Croatian uniform. He was shot very poorly in the qualifying tournament. I think he shot like 28%, only averaged like 5 points a game despite playing 20 minutes a game. So it doesn't look like he's going to be a primary option. They do need his shooting and athleticism though. They've also got Shimon, who is a shooting guard, who another guy who's going to have to play a lot and shoot the ball, because their point guards really are not good shooters, like Roko Jukic, who is older now, but I think had a cup of coffee with the Raptors years ago. He's not a guy who can shoot the ball at all. And then another guy just to watch, just kind of for fun, Darko Planinic, who got some good playing time for them at center. I've just always liked his game. He's a bull. He plays hard. He's got nice short hooks with both hands. We'll get on the offensive board. I mean, he doesn't have the athleticism to be like a real high level center, but I've always just enjoyed like how hard that guy plays.
Yeah, and in tournaments like this, where it's hard to put in an offense or like a real set offense, and if you don't have a point guard who can create, it's really hard to be successful in these tournaments, and that's a big reason why I don't think Croatia will do that well. I think they'll get knocked out pretty early. I'd be really surprised if they make it to the medal rounds. But
oh really? Yeah. Oh, so you don't think they're gonna even make the final eight?
Oh, they'll make the final eight. I'm talking about the final four. I think they'll get knocked out in the quarterfinals, no matter what. I think they'll finish second in the group though, because I think Lithuania is tanking that game.
Yeah, Saric is someone who, especially as he gets older, he has been effective playing for his country, and at 6'9", playing the four, there are not many teams. Again, we talk about how a lot of these teams really lack quality wings with size. Him playing the four, he's got a huge advantage against whoever he's matched up against at the four for the other team. So I do think if he really goes off and causes problems, then maybe they could surprise a little bit. But I think they just don't have really much depth beyond Bogdanovic and Saric to cause anybody problems once they get into the final eight, as you said. So I think that's everyone, right? Yeah, Argentina, we talked about them a little bit. So what is what's your prediction for the tournament? Give me your gold, silver, bronze, and fourth place.
I have the U.S. finishing first. Something really drastic needs to happen, or either on the court somebody gets injured, or something outside of the court, like somebody not knowing how to use Snapchat correctly. But it's hard for me to see the U.S. losing a game, or it's just not going to happen. It's probably going to be Spain, France in the other semifinal, which can go either way, as we all know. Somehow I have a feeling Spain might be the better of the two teams. I think they will have Spain in the final again. I think France will finish third, and then fourth would be probably again Lithuania, who somehow manages to sneak up on everybody each tournament when nobody really expects them to. But I think Lithuania either finishing third or fourth, but probably fourth. Behind France.
Yeah, I think we're largely in agreement there. Maybe the only way I think that you could see maybe Serbia instead of Lithuania is, I think there's really kind of a very clear top five in this tournament with Serbia, yeah, in addition to the teams that you mentioned. But Serbia, the interesting thing about them is if you assume France comes second in Group A, then Serbia is going to be the third place finisher. They'll go up against the second place finisher in Group B, which probably might be either Lithuania or Croatia. And I think Serbia can beat either of those teams, and then that would put them in the semifinal against the U.S. So am I right about that?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. A really good point. If France and Spain are in the other semifinal, and the U.S., the team who's going against them will most likely actually in that case be Serbia, because I think Lithuania, I had them finishing third. So that would mean that they would have to be France in the quarterfinals. But yeah, a clear top five, as you said, but I'm actually changing my Lithuania pick to Serbia to finish fourth, because I think France beats Lithuania in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, I agree with you. You were right. Last year you had Spain winning Eurobasket. I had France. That ended up not being correct. We'll see if you're right this year. I am going to say that France is going to beat Spain this year. But I do think that is going to be a very close game. And the difference between the U.S., I mean, you sort of think of it as, okay, there's the U.S., but then it's not like, okay, there's the U.S. and there's Spain, and then there's another gap that's that equal size down to the rest of the group. So I think you could see upsets. Same thing with France. You know, the difference between Spain and France versus a Lithuania or even a Croatia is much smaller than the difference between those teams to the U.S. And the U.S., I think I agree with you. If we had Spain 2012 or Spain 2008 in this tournament, I would actually be kind of worried as a U.S. homer, but they've kind of fallen off, and it's kind of too bad that there isn't really that team that can kind of push the U.S. I think. And the other thing about the U.S. too is I think since Thibodeau came on board in 2014, their defense has been so good, whereas before that you had teams that actually could kind of light them up a little bit, like Lithuania, Spain in 2012, Spain in 2008, Argentina at times would actually score pretty well on them. And now that Tibbs is on there, they have really tightened up the defense. They have a lot of defensive talent. So even if the threes aren't falling for them, they get in foul trouble, I think there's just no way anybody can score well enough on them to really give them any problems.
Exactly. And if you go back and watch, like, even the 2000 Olympics, but especially 2004,
I'm not going to go back and watch that.
Okay, fine. But from a tactical perspective, the U.S., it became such isolation ball, and the teams weren't really constructed well at all. And Europe actually took really large leaps tactically, which the U.S. in the past years, especially with, it started with D'Antoni and then with Popovich, started taking a lot of European influences with, ball and personal movement on the court. And, like if you watch in 2004, it used to be normal that the point guard dribbles to the top of the 3-point line and then you play a set. And now you see almost always the ball is passed past the half court line. And it's just such a big difference. And the tactical advantage that Europe used to have in the early 2000s, it's just not there anymore. And actually the bigger tactical breakthroughs are coming from the NBA and the US in general now. So the Europe really doesn't have an advantage anywhere, since they don't have the athletes to compete, nor are they tactically as competitive as they, or they don't have the advantage that they used to. And I think actually the US is tactically even better than the European teams at the moment. If you watch EuroLeague versus the NBA, which used to be like the big issue with Europeans, they would rather watch EuroLeague games because it's tactically better. The pick and roll play is smarter and stuff like that. But that's changed the past 4 years for sure.
Interesting. I haven't heard that coming from your side of the pond. But yeah, I mean, when you go back even like 2000, when they almost lost to Lithuania, it was all just, hey, let's just try and post up and, like, you know, no allowance for the fact that there was zone defense and they didn't have guys who could shoot. They were playing two bigs. And then of course, the other thing too that people don't talk about from that kind of nadir, I agree that the program needed a lot of work, but when they actually had their best guys, even during that period, the one time they had their best guys was the 03 Tournament of the Americas, and they completely dominated it in that. And then just everybody decided, due to security concerns or whatever, that they weren't going to go to Athens, and they had to kind of bring, you know, the C team outside of basically Allen Iverson and Tim Duncan. So, and then even 06 wasn't close to the best Americans at the time. So when we've had our best guys, I think we've done well.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely happy that we've like gotten our act together, because it was the 02, 04, 06 were like some of my lowest moments as a basketball fan for sure. And I do not like to think about that. I do not like to think about what number six or whatever the heck it was that Coach K called Theo Papaloukas in 2006 when he did to us. So
exactly.
we will put a moratorium on that discussion on this podcast from now on.
All right.
Agreed. All right, buddy. Well, thanks so much for coming on. We always appreciate having your unique perspective from Europe, and we'll see what happens in this tournament. Hope to have you on again soon.
Thanks a lot.